The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the February 24th, 2014 edition of The Heretics Hour. I have a very interesting program lined up. And before we begin, though, I want to make just a couple of announcements. I want to thank Dimitar for his two donations. I'm reminding listeners tonight that I'm not getting enough contributions at this point to pay for my three servers, and that's all I ask, is that I get my, you know, expenses paid, and also I have an administrator for my Carolyn Yeager site and Ellie Weasel and another one too, and not for the Not White Network, but he requires some reimbursement. I mean, I just give him something that I decided on, but he does a lot of work for me that I can't do for myself. So, you know, I just don't want to have to pay all this out of my own pocket. If I can want to, you know, I'm never expecting to make a living. I'm never expecting to get extra money or anything. I never have, but, sometimes things get a little slow, and it does help to remind people, particularly if you're a regular listener or a regular reader of my site, a little something once in a while would help a lot. And I appreciate Dimitar. Every month he sends something to both the White Network and to CarolynYeager.com. And that's where you go on PayPal for my sites. It's Carolyn at CarolynYeager.com, which I don't use anymore, but that's what it is on PayPal. So I know I've confused people quite a bit with that change, those two different .com and .nets that are used. But I posted the latest installment of the Leopold Wenger letters today, this morning, or actually last night, but I was still fixing it up this morning. Letters from the Western, Southern, and Eastern Front. He was on all those three fronts, and this new one is from Sicily, and then he's back in Germany, and then he's moving on to the Eastern Front. This one ends at the end of 1943. So you might want to take a look at that. And I want to announce that I have new break music for this program, too, as well as I had new music on Saturday. This, what I have for Heretics Hour, is not actually new, because I used it on the Saturday afternoon program when I first started that show. And now I'm bringing it to the Heretics Hour because I do like it so very much. And so sometimes I'll just use music again that I've used before. And this is the Gute Nacht song from Schubert's Winterreise, sung by the great baritone tenor, or tenor baritone, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau. And it's quite a change from the swing music I've had for a while. So that's what you'll hear tonight at our break. And so now to our topic and guest, and who is Margaret Hufstickler. And Margaret is a singer in her own right. And so since I've been talking about this Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, hi, Margaret. Welcome to the show. And why don't you tell us a little bit about your singing career?
Oh, okay. Well, I wasn't ready for that. I haven't done a lot of singing in my career. My my professional career was largely singing in the chorus of the Washington Opera. But other than that, I've given recitals and sung in a few smaller opera productions, lead roles, and that's about it. But I was very lucky. I studied with a woman who sang at the Metropolitan Opera for 40 years, and I studied with her for 10 years in the 90s, and so that kind of got my voice together. So that's always nice to have, is a solid vocal technique. And I'm glad to hear that there's going to be some beautiful Schubert music tonight. I love Schubert.
Yes, yeah, you can't go wrong with Schubert. Well, I think that's wonderful, you know, because I am very poor in singing. I don't have a good voice. I can't sing on key, you know, for any more than a few notes at a time, it seems like. And I never have been a singer, and you are also a good linguist or good at languages, and I'm not good at that either. So you know, we have different talents for sure, but we get along, and we come together when it comes to the Third Reich. We're going to be talking about it. I was interested in having you tell us also just a little bit briefly, you know, real briefly, but how did you come to this interest in the Third Reich and your, you know, approval of it? Does it go way, way back, or is it?
No, not at all. You know, for so many years, I was just concentrated. I did acting as well as singing, and I taught acting, and I really didn't think about politics or anything at all. But what happened, my father was a poet named Albert Hofstickler, a wonderful poet who lived in Austin, Texas, and he died in 2002 fairly suddenly, and I went there and stayed for a month going through his papers in Austin. And then just when I was flying back, it was 2002, and it was when the when Israel had gone into the West Bank and was doing horrible things there in the Jenin massacre. And I was reading about it on the plane on the way back. And I had a Jewish boyfriend at that time. So when I got back home, I said, "Oh, hey, look at this. This is terrible." And of course his response was, "Israel has to defend herself." I'm like, "Oh." So I looked online, of course. And that was just when all that revisionist history about Israel had come up, because the records of the Israeli, the creation of the Israeli state, 50 years was up in 1998, and to their credit, the government let all these papers go public. And so all these revisionist historians there were having a field day and writing all this revisionist history, not that they disapproved of what they'd done, but they started saying, "Yeah, we chased them out, we massacred them, we did it," you know. And so it was very interesting. And I read this claim on one of the sites I was reading that said that in the displaced persons camps after the war, they had representatives there from Israel to push people to the front of the lines to say, "I want to go to Israel, I want to go to Israel." Because most of them, of course, would rather have come to the United States. I read that and I thought, that sounds so conspiratorial. And so I looked it up in a few other places and it was definitely true. And so then I thought, well, how far back does this go? I started looking farther back and, you know, there you go. All that revisionist material.
Wow, and you caught on real quick, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sure didn't take long because it's lucky that all that great material is online.
Yes, it is. It is. Once, you know, if you're inclined at all, I mean, once you start seeing it, I mean, it all falls into place pretty fast. It did for me. Well, I'm glad that you have been saved from having Jewish boyfriends.
Yeah, well, you know, I tried, he is a chemist, and I tried showing him, Germar Rudolph's report. I was sure that it would convince him, but nope.
That's interesting.
Yeah, you know, no, they
finish that.
No, I just, they're insulated against that. He would just read the Jewish site that purported to refute it instead of just looking at it with his logical mind.
Okay, now I don't know what the list, no, there it is. The sound was real low. I have to tell you something, Margaret, while you were talking about that towards the beginning of your, how you got into revisionism and so on, all of a sudden there was this whooshy sound that I've never heard before, and you got a lot louder, because remember I told you you had gotten less loud, and now suddenly, just a little bit ago, just before I started talking, you went back to being real hard to hear again, and when I can see the sound, the recording level, it's real loud for me, but plenty loud. But when you were on, it went all way, way down. So what is going on there? You get going from loud to...
I wonder if there's any loose connection here or anything. Is there any change when I do this? Because what I'm doing is moving the cord a little bit in back of the microphone.
No, but you're way down in the 200 and 300 300-400 level, and I'm at 6,000 and 5,000. So,
wow.
Well, yeah, I think you're going to have to just talk real loud.
I'll just speak loudly.
And then if you get when you get loud again, I'll have to tell you to.
Okay. Tell me if this is loud enough. Is this okay?
Well, I think it is for me, but I want to ask the listeners at this point. You know, I've been having trouble with static and the last few shows, and I didn't realize it was me. I thought it was my guest, and finally after listening to the programs, I noticed it was only happening while I was speaking. So I've been talking with Margaret about that, and I went out, I thought it was my mic, and I went out and bought a new headset today, and I got a good one as far as what you get at these, you know, off the counter here, counters, and tried it out today, and the same thing, had exactly the same static. I tried different ports in my computer, and all the same. So it seems to be something in my computer. So I was going to let Margaret do most of the talking tonight because I really find that static irritating. I don't know if it's happening right now. And I would like listeners who, I don't need everybody to do it, but you can write a send an email to Carolyn at CarolynJaeger.net, or if you're a Skype contact of mine or a Skype contact of Margaret's, you can send us a Skype message telling us, you know, what you notice about the sound. Because now if she's going to have this problem, we're both going to have problems. And I can't adjust, I can't adjust it. But the Skype tries to adjust it in, and I think the recording, software tries to adjust it for the finished recording, but I'm really at a loss of what's going on here with you going back and forth, Margaret. But
yes, because I'm not touching it.
Yeah, and you also sound a little bit like you're in an echo, not echoey, but has that funny sound like you're in a big, are you in a big empty kind of room?
No, not at all. I'm in a small, not empty room.
You sound, have that far away sound. But then when that.
I'm going to try sitting closer to my mic. This is I'm going to move a little.
But if you get real loud again, I'll have to tell you, and you get further away from your mic again. This is going to be quite the program here, I guess.
Quite the dance.
That sounds a lot better.
Oh, okay. I'm closer now.
It sounds great now.
Oh, okay. Well, I know it sounded fine before when I was standing up. I have this computer, so my laptop's on a desk where I can sit down, and then I have, screen where I can stand up. So I was standing, and then the mic is farther away. So I'll just sit for all of this. That'll be fine.
Oh yeah, yeah. I always sit.
But I didn't change it in all that time. So hopefully it'll stay good. Maybe it was
all right. Okay. Well, it sounds good for now. So let's move along here. You're going to be talking about the Gestapo, which you already started talking about a while back, not very long ago, but, and we just did the kind of the first part of, excuse me, of Vincent Renoir's, all his research. He put together a whole big package of material. I don't know if it was ever published in a book or not.
Yes, it was in Sans Concession magazine. The first part was the last. That's his wonderful magazine, which means without concession.
So
it was.
Well, you go ahead, and you were going to talk about the Barnes Review and all of that, how that came about, and then you're going to go on and give a rundown or talk about all the rest of the Gestapo.
Okay.
It's there. So.
Okay. Good. This was an article that Vincent Renoir wrote. It was in two parts. The shorter part was in the last issue. I don't have it in front of me, so I don't remember the month, but I think it was December 2006. And then the next installment was the first issue of 2007. And that was a much longer article, and that's what we're going to be talking about this time. The first section, for people who weren't here, was about the Gestapo in Germany, between 1933 and 1939, when what we concluded and what Renoir concluded was that it was a perfectly ordinary state police force, political police force, such as everyone has to protect themselves from traitors and enemies within their borders. What happened was that I did an article. Vincent wrote this article in Sans Concession, and then Carlos Porter at his site did a translation of it into English, which is a little hard to read for various reasons. But the Barnes Review wanted me to do an article which is just putting together the salient points of Vincent's work, which I did, both based on his own article and on Carlos Porter's translation. And so it's very, very compacted. And if anyone wants to see the whole thing, they can go to Carlos Porter's site. I really think it should be translated into German. I don't know if it has been. I did it. I gave it in Spanish at Pedro Varela's group in Barcelona in 2011, the end of 2011. And people really liked it there. I mean, because most people just don't know this information about the Gestapo. It's one of the last bastions, I think. So it came out in the Barnes Review in the January issue, and then the March and the May issue in three parts of 2011. And while we're talking about the Barnes Review, I want to mention that they have a wonderful half-price special for subscriptions right now. It's just beginning. And so if anybody wants to get this wonderful revisionist magazine, while it's much cheaper than usual, it would be only $23 for a year subscription, which is six issues. This would only be for the U.S. They can't afford it for other countries because of the postage. And all you have to do to get this is to simply call them. It's not online, but just by calling, and just ask for the half-price special. And you'll get it for $23 for the whole year. And it's a wonderful magazine.
Wow, that's a great deal.
Yeah, it's a great deal.
That's great. Okay.
Wow. And it's not just World War II or the Holocaust. It's all kinds of revisionist history. It's Civil War, Revolutionary War, prehistory, you name it. And here's the phone number to call if you want to take advantage of this.
Okay.
It's one. Okay, get pencils ready if you're interested. It's 877-773-9077. And there's no code to give or anything, just half price special.
Okay.
Okay. You could put that on your site.
You can mention that later on in the show again in the phone number.
Oh, okay. That sounds good.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to start out before I go on to the second part of this article, which is about the, Gestapo in the occupied countries, especially France, really just France. That's all he really talks about. Before I go there, I want to make up for an omission from last time, because I forgot to say something very important at the end, which is not only was the Gestapo just a perfectly legal, ordinary political police force, but the Nuremberg Tribunal, although they found them to be a criminal organization, because, of course, they had already decided that in advance, yet the evidence was so strong for the time before the war that they were just an ordinary police force that they were only found to be a criminal organization starting in September of 1939. So they are absolutely cleared of all this reign of terror stuff that is still spread around about them during the time before. And Renoir asks, why do they cover that up? Of course, it's because they want people to think that it was a reign of terror. And for one thing, they just don't want anybody to think that maybe people were happy then. And maybe they liked having the National Socialists in power, which is, of course, the fact. They were just a simple tool of protection of the state against subversive minorities. Didn't have to send hundreds of thousands of people to the camps because the vast majority supported them.
That's right.
Yep. So then we're going to go into the truth about the Gestapo part two. Hidden revelations of the post-war trials. So Renoir imagines a critic saying, okay, so fine, the Gestapo didn't have to persecute the German population because the Germans accepted them, the Nazi dictatorship. But that doesn't mean anything. During the war, they showed their true colors. They were sowing terror in the occupied territories, arresting people, deporting them, torturing them. They were acting in accordance with a racist Hitlerian doctrine, according to which anyone who was not pure German was subhuman, could be vilified, humiliated, tortured, killed, etc. Of course, Renoir says that is not true, and he refutes these allegations point by point in this second part of the article. He starts with the heading, "The Real Purpose of the Allied Crusade and Its Consequences for Germany," because he wants to put things in context. It's really important to understand why they acted as they did. He says all the actions of the Gestapo in the occupied territories must be placed in the context of the fact that the war declared on Germany on September 3rd, 1939 was a war of extermination. Even according to Christian morality, and Renoir is a devout traditional Catholic, he says self-defense is permitted. Thomas Aquinas said that if one kills to defend one's life, one is not guilty of homicide. Well, Renoir says what's true of a person is also true of Germany. By 1940, it had become totally clear that the war was not about defending Poland, but about the complete destruction of Germany. He says, right. If you want to judge National Socialism, or more particularly the Gestapo, one must judge it in times of peace, not in wartime. And especially not during the last 2 years of the war, when everything was collapsing in Germany, the enemy was destroying its cities one by one, exterminating its women and children, and continuing, promising to continue till unconditional surrender. And as we know, way past that too, which they couldn't know, but unconditional surrender is a very, very scary term, and it was unheard of before that time. So in other words, what the victors chose to call Nazi barbarism, or the result of a racist police state, was really the consequence of the war of extermination that the Allies declared on the Reich. And on top of that, the resistance, the growing organized resistance to the occupying forces, and the growing resentment by the French people that was a consequence of the reprisals by the Germans against the partisan atrocities. All of this took a toll on the mood of the Gestapo, even as the situation was becoming more and more desperate. So having placed this in context, the arguments, Renoir goes on to specifics. And his first subject is the omnipresence and omnipotence of the Gestapo in the occupied territories. Of course, if one believes the stories of the Resistance members, the Gestapo was everywhere. They were an illegal arms caches discovered, Gestapo. A search, it's the Gestapo. A network is dismantled, the Gestapo. Gestapo, Gestapo. It's the arbitrary power of the Gestapo. It's supposed to have been a monster with immense power present everywhere at once to cause a reign of terror in the occupied territories. Of course, that is not the way it was. We already saw in the first part that they simply didn't have the resources, and that was even more so, more true when you get to France. They just simply didn't have the capability. They didn't have reservists to call on as regular police did. They also didn't have enough
arms, trucks, radio equipment, etc. When Ernst Kaltenbrunner was questioned at Nuremberg on the number of Gestapo personnel in occupied France, he said he believed he had heard a figure of around 800. So that's a pretty paltry figure. If you consider the proportion would be the same as in Germany, which was 80-20 of bureaucrats to field officers, you end up with about 160 active Gestapo agents in all of occupied France.
I don't know if you have this planned out for later or at some point, but I think it would be good to inform us about who was the head of the Gestapo and what relationship did Reinhard Heydrich have with it. And
okay.
Then Ernst Kaltenbrunner took over from Heydrich after he was assassinated. And just how he did and, you know, what difference.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? I don't know very much about these things. I'm not at all an expert on the Gestapo. I know what Vincent Renoir wrote, basically. Mm-hmm. I do know that all of, there were several agencies, as you'll hear, in France and in the different countries. Not all of them were Gestapo. And they were under different command, but all the commands were under Heydrich for a while. In 1939, they were all placed under Heydrich, and then after him under Kaltenbrunner. But they were each separate.
And then the Gestapo was one of those?
Yes, it was one of four that were.
So Heinrich Müller being head of the Gestapo, and then over above him, but not directly, you know, running the Gestapo, but above him is all of the police forces was Heydrich.
Yes, and then
kind of like that.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And then underneath, as we will hear, below these Gestapo are auxiliaries, which we're about to hear about. But first I'll say, so for here you've got 160 active Gestapo agents in all of occupied France. Of course, that doesn't mean that there weren't other German police, because there are the other agencies. But these 160 Gestapo agents were divided among four different services. It wasn't all chasing the partisans. It included suppression of the black market and tracking of German deserters. So there were only really maybe 40 or so were all the incredible oppressive things they're supposed to have been doing. So much for them as a omnipresent, omnipotent monster in the occupied territories. This next section is Gestapo as scapegoat, and it's about the fact that because they had so few people, the Gestapo needed to found auxiliaries in the occupied territories that were recruited from people there. Many of those people were not trained for police work, and some of them were of dubious character. Of course, if these people did anything wrong, it was all blamed on the Gestapo, as were actions of other branches of German law enforcement. Really, anything that happened that had to do with any German police, it's Gestapo. Post-liberation trials of auxiliaries in France, Renoir bases this part of his article mainly on transcripts of four French trials that took place in between 1944 and 1947 in so-called liberated France. It was of four different auxiliaries. One was called there's only two that are really mentioned much in this, in my condensation of this article that I'm using, which are, the two are the Bonnie Lafont gang, they were called, and the Georgia Gestapo. But there were four different trials. There was a Gestapo of Neuilly, and then there was a trial of the auxiliaries of the French Gestapo or something like that. So these four, he really analyzed a lot of testimony, and you can, if you go to Carlos Porter's site, you can read a lot of anecdotes, which I didn't have.
All right. It's incredible. That's where I'm at, you know, and I mean, it just goes on and on. So it's he's really mm-hmm. done, like I say, he's got a tremendous amount of factual research here.
Yeah, yeah, he went to the bibliothèque,
right.
And just went through these, and he got some real gems. But the previous histories of the leaders of these police units gives you an idea of some of the composition that you're dealing with in the auxiliaries, which is not up to the standards of a real German police force. For instance, Henri Lafon, of the Bonny Lafon group, had an unfortunate childhood. He was orphaned at 11, lived under a bridge. He was homeless, and later, was convicted of various petty crimes. In fact, the way he got recruited was that he was in prison, and the Blitzkrieg happened, and two German prisoners who had been in prison with him, they were all let free, and they're like, well, hey, you could work for us, and so he went to work for them. But many of his group, the Bonny Lafon group, were recruited among men that he knew from his stretches in prison. And his partner, Pierre Bonny, was a former chief inspector of police, which is good, but he had been fired as a result of a couple of serious scandals. The head of the Georgia Gestapo, Chalva Odicharia, was a troubled adventurer from Cluny, Georgia, who'd been a refugee in France since the 20s. So there, it's not the creme de la creme. Though there were.
And these were people who were functioning for the Gestapo?
Yeah, they set up their police, you know, their police headquarters, and they worked, and they actually, you know, this, as you'll hear, this Henri Lafon was not a bad guy. He really did a pretty good job, but some of his people were not so great. But they, I mean, some of the people were good and came into the agency for very good reasons. For instance, there was a man named Georges Collignon, who was born of a respectable family. He was working as a broker. He was well educated, and he joined the Georgia Gestapo because he saw what was happening, that the resistance actions were causing these reprisals, and it had been a peaceful occupation before that, because, as you know, the Germans tried to follow all the rules of the so-called rules of war, which was you maintain a peaceful occupation, and they behaved very well. But what happened, and Botchaka pointed this out, if anybody read the Partisan War, which was attached to the PDF of the first part of the Gestapo article, Botchaka points out that until Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, there was no resistance. Nobody cared, because really it was run mostly from the communists. So once he attacked the communists, then the resistance suddenly came, you know, became very active, and then things went to hell in a handbasket.
You're still talking about France, though.
Yes, this is France.
And this Georgia, Gestapo was in France.
In France, yes. He came from Georgia. The head of it came from Georgia.
And that's why they called it that. Okay.
Yes, and same as Lafon recruited people from prisons that he'd been in, this guy from Georgia recruited a lot of Georgians for his group. So, yes, that's why it was called that. So this Collignon, gave evidence at his trial. He said, they asked him why he had joined, and he said it was necessary to prevent the situations that were occurring, the communist sabotage and assassinations, because the Germans threatened to carry out mass deportations and executions in reprisal. And he was trying to, prevent these assassinations and bombings, which would put the French people in hopeless situations.
Right. So they were saying these people knew that there were going to be reprisals from the Germans.
Exactly.
But they wanted that. They wanted that so that they could create a lot of animosity. Exactly. And dislike of the Germans.
Exactly. They did not want a peaceful occupation. No. And they didn't care about the French being killed. A lot of them weren't French anyway. But if they were, they didn't care. They were, a lot of them were Jewish communists in there inciting people.
The German, so many things I've read and looked at and so on, and that the Germans had a very difficult situation in France. Most of the French people were going along with things, but these agitators and the communists and the Jews, and often they were one and the same, were very good at creating all this sabotage and all this stuff that that made the Germans have to react, you know.
Mm-hmm. And that was the purpose of the main purpose of the partisans.
Yeah. So I mean, it was a difficult job. It's difficult when you're occupying a country. It's very hard to do.
Yeah, and of course, people are, a lot of them understood, but all the propaganda was, he's just trying to, conquer the world, and he's in France because that's his first step to conquer the world. No, of course, he was there defensively, and he would leave once he's done. They don't have to resist. There doesn't have to be any resistance. As soon as the war's over, he's going to get out anyway. Mm-hmm. It was totally ridiculous for any reason except to cause trouble, which it really did. Collignon, this good guy, said, "I'm not talking about ideals. I've said that I'm an advocate of order." The judge says, "What order?" And Collignon says, "That order prevails, that our lives are not constantly in danger." Of course, he was ultimately sentenced to death.
Oh.
Personally, writes Renoir, "I take my hat off to him. I salute you, Georges Collignon."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that. I'm right there.
Was the Gestapo in France racist? This is his next section. One of the establishment's favorite claims about the Gestapo, as we've seen, is that they are the enforcement arm of a racist police state. However, if you look at the records of the post-war trials, that thesis is reduced to, in Renoir's words, a nullity. There is no grounds, of course. There are no grounds for that accusation. We've seen that in many other cases. No, they're not racist. One of the examples of the lack of racism of the Gestapo in France that Renoir gives is a man named Mohamed El Mahdi, who was a North African Arab Berber from a noble family. He was a knight of the Légion d'honneur, a holder of the Médaille Militaire and the Croix de Guerre, three great, great medals. I guess he must have been in the First World War to get those. He was living in Paris under the occupation. In 1943, he founded a monthly newspaper entitled Air Rachid, in which he wrote numerous editorials. Both his impressions of the racist Germans and his interactions with them contradict the thesis that they were racist. From the very first issue, he announced his objective as being a struggle for the liberation of North Africa alongside the Germans. He said, "Our duty is to free ourselves from the Judeo-Anglo-Saxon ascendancy. Alongside the European armies, we must undertake the struggle for liberation of our territory." So in his paper, and there are many examples also, which there's no time to give, of just talking about how when the French were in charge of one of their territories, they paid them very badly, or in what he called monkey money. I don't know what that means. And wouldn't let them ride on the same transportation, et cetera. As soon as the Germans got in, they paid them, good wages. They rode on the same transportation. They were not racist. After the first few issues of this paper, El Mahdi had a difficult time getting paper to print it on. So he went to the French Gestapo, which was the Bonnet Lafont gang, and he spoke with Henri Lafont. So did Lafont tell this Untermensch to get lost? No. He helped him. He got him the paper he needed, and it ended up that his paper was printed on the presses of the major collaborationist newspaper Paris Soir, And then, as a result of this relationship with El Mahdi, the Germans above Lafont decided to recruit North Africans, just as they'd previously recruited Georgians in the Georgia Gestapo. And eventually there were five sections of 30 to 50 men set up as a legion of French volunteers against Bolshevism. So that pretty much puts paid to the idea of these racist doctrines that were supposed to have motivated the Gestapo. Renoir's next topic is, was the Gestapo in France arbitrary? Here's a claim from a man named François de Menton, who was the French prosecutor at Nuremberg. In his opening summation on January 17, 1946, at the beginning of the trial of the Gestapo as a criminal organization, he said, on a simple, unverified denunciation, without previous investigation, masses of arbitrary arrests took place in every occupied country. But, of course, as you know, that's not true at all. Renoir makes the following points. First of all, many denunciations were not even followed up. Because they had such a shortage of manpower and means, they couldn't act on every denunciation. First of all, they needed clear evidence, otherwise the case would be dropped. Other denunciations would be ignored because they just weren't serious enough to justify further action. Others just fell between the cracks, so it was not arbitrary. Yes, get everybody in our net.
Yeah, and they didn't just, what they mean, they didn't just make decisions on the spur of the moment because they wanted to do this to this person, wanted to do that to somebody else, or, you know, just went after people. I mean, they were very professional police force, basically, except for some of these oddballs like you mentioned in France.
That's right. And they were under, as I said, this Lafont, even though he didn't come from a great background, he seemed to have a good character, and he really tried to do the right thing, and and his partner was a professional chief of police, and so they were following procedures. It says people who were arrested and who had done nothing wrong were usually released, and others who were guilty but there was no proof against them were frequently given the benefit of the doubt and released. There was also a required procedure, as we saw in Germany, that severely limited the possibility of arbitrary action. After a denunciation had been received by the auxiliaries and they'd done a preliminary investigation, which they couldn't do unless there was enough evidence to warrant that, then they had to send a report uplines to the German agency to which they were accountable. Different auxiliaries were accountable to different agencies. And only after it had gone up to the German agencies and they had evaluated the report and given orders could the auxiliaries proceed to action.
Well, you know, I think that I have found that they were always very careful in the court systems, and I guess now in the police work, that giving people They did have to have evidence. This whole idea, this whole thinking that, oh, they just grabbed people, they just made things up, they did things like the Soviets did, is not true at all. That they when they had these programs for sterilization and so on, and gave people every opportunity to show that they shouldn't be have to
participate
in that program. Every opportunity.
Even sometimes when they wanted to be sterilized, I think you must have read that chapter by Lothrop Stoddard about
I did read that, yes.
Yeah, that was it impressed me a lot, just how they bent over backwards to not do the sterilization unless it was absolutely called for.
Right. And I thought that in that chapter, there are a couple people they allowed to be, to not be sterilized, and I thought they should have been. I wouldn't have been that lenient, but But that's across the board in Germany. It was all like that. And just because some of these people were convicted of things who deserve to be convicted, but who are now considered to be, you know, heroes of the,
yeah,
so on. People think that they were going around convicting innocent people. It's not true.
Yeah, and you know, another thing that struck me in that chapter was how kind they were. They were very, very, you know, treated those people very well who came before them.
Yes, yeah, that group of judges and doctors and so on.
So back to the Gestapo, similarly, it says also, supposing that you found very strong evidence of guilt, the agents still couldn't do anything on their own. The accused still had to go before a judge. The judge would decide their guilt or innocence, and if they were found guilty, would sentence them. And here's an interesting case that shows what can really happen. How do you categorize it? This man was named Bernard Humbert. After he went before a judge and he was acquitted for lack of evidence, he was held in spite of that because there had just been communist assassinations and they needed hostages for negotiations. But 10 days later, here's his testimony. He says, on November 14th, 1941, my mother and my wife, who was about to give birth to our sixth child, came to see me. And they mentioned the birth of my sixth child, which was about to occur. Seeing that my sixth child was about to be born, they then released me. So, there you go. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was kind of arbitrary, actually, but in a good way.
Yes. Right. I think that was very common. You know, there are a lot of people who say the Germans were too nice at that time, the National Socialists were too nice. They were very nice. I mean, I don't like that word nice, but they had heart. They never stopped having
good
heart.
Guys. They were good guys.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, that reminds me, another time I'd be very interested on your show to present a very interesting article by Renoir, which is more upbeat. It's about a program for the wives of French prisoners of war. And I wrote it, I translated it for the Barnes Review a couple of years ago, and they've never used it so far, but I really want people to hear about it. So don't let me forget. I'd love to present that at some point.
Okay.
Okay, so finally, in this idea of arbitrariness, Renoir looks at the evidence in the 63 Gestapo cases that were mentioned in the French trials with an eye to determining the guilt or innocence of the so-called victims. And he found that only four of those probably involved innocent people. So that's 59 out of 63. He says, with these exceptions, all the involved persons were obviously guilty of illegal acts, manufacturing false papers, giving information to the enemy, dealing in weapons, attempted murder, etc. That's an accuracy rate of 93%, not arbitrary.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This is an interesting section. Did the Gestapo sow terror? Were the ordinary people of France terrified of the Gestapo? Of course, that would be the case if the Gestapo in occupied France had lived up to its future monstrous reputation. But, of course, Renoir presents several cases that prove the opposite. The first one is of a French prefect who absolutely refused to carry out an order of the Gestapo. This prefect got a message from a commander of the Gestapo of Lyon that he was going to receive a sealed bag containing a cadaver. He was supposed to incinerate the bag without opening it. Well, he indignantly refused. That was not official procedure. It was supposed to be opened, the corpse identified, etc. Well, the commander got angry and said, well, the regional prefect of Lyon never raises objections in such cases. Well, Jacques Henri is this prefect we're talking about. He immediately telephoned the regional prefect of Lyon to ask if it was true. As he later testified, He asked me to put the commander on the line. I held the receiver and was thus able to hear the regional prefect deny the allegation and call the German a liar. The Gestapo made repeated requests for 48 hours, which Henri continued to refuse, and they finally gave up. Well, they didn't come and kill him and, you know, bury him in the backyard or something. No.
Well, this guy just kept refusing, and finally they didn't push it.
Yeah, that's right.
Ah!
And here's a few cases in which after a search by the Gestapo, which was really by these local auxiliaries, some of whom had sticky fingers, money or jewelry was found to be missing. If the victims of these thefts had been terrified of the Gestapo, they would obviously have kept quiet and thanked their lucky stars they hadn't been arrested and tortured and sent to concentration camps. But no, they didn't keep quiet. They filed complaints against the Gestapo for theft. In the case of one woman, Madame Play, whose husband and son had been arrested and they were eventually deported, when she discovered the theft, she immediately went to the Felt Gendarmerie, her local Gestapo place, which sent a telegram to Paris. In Paris, Henri Lafont, again, our same person, of the Bonny Lafont gang, gathered all his men together, gave some pretty strong threats, and found out who the thief was, and returned what was left of the stolen jewels.
So these agents, Gestapo agents, were sometimes stealing things.
Yeah, these were the French, you know, as I said, he recruited a lot of his, this is the French auxiliaries. This is not the Germans. The Germans had very strong rules about looting. But this was, he had, as I said, filled his gang with a lot of people he met in prison, and some of them were not.
Okay. So they always figured they had to make a little something on the side. That mm-hmm. was just the way they did business. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to clarify that.
Yeah. So it appears from the records that he punished, Lafont punished thefts by his men very severely and did his best to prevent this behavior. But Renoir's point is that filing complaints against the Gestapo for theft, calling a commandant of the Gestapo a liar, or adamantly refusing to follow his orders are not the behaviors of a terrorized population.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
So we're starting to get into the real, it's probably almost time for the break, but we're starting to get into some of the really interesting territory here now. Was the Gestapo authorized to torture?
Yeah, we got about 5 minutes.
Okay, so we'll probably go through this and then it'll be break time. In support of their contention that the Gestapo practiced torture, people who uphold this standard narrative cite two decrees that were put out by the German government in 1937 and 1942. And I'm not sure if this is, I see that later I wrote, here I wrote 43 and afterwards I wrote 42. So I'm not sure which it was, but anyway, they were these two different decrees. And, the first one was by Reinhard Heydrich, and it authorized intensified interrogations, verschärfte Vernehmungen, which is equivalent to third degree, in order to nip in the bud actions of conspirators and enemies of the state. Now, this is interesting. The decree stipulated that such techniques could never be used in order to extort confessions, but only to obtain important information. Carl Best.
Well, repeat that. They could not.
They couldn't use it. Yeah, this is very important. They could not use that to extract confessions. It was not used for that. It was used only if you were trying to obtain important information.
Okay.
And this was not actual what we might consider torture, though it wouldn't be any fun, I guess. Carl Best, and I forgot.
Now, what would some of this torture be? What is involved there in this, what they call
well,
torture?
The first of the two decrees permitted, as the most severe of several options, the administration of 20 blows with a stick on the buttocks of the recalcitrant interrogee.
That's torture? I thought that was, that doesn't feel, I mean, that's kind of bad, but not what I think of as torture, but I guess,
Renoir didn't specify it like this. I read this somewhere else, and I'm not sure where, but he just said beating, but I remember this very specifically. It was 20 blows with a stick on the buttocks, and it was not allowed to be repeated. That's a one-time thing. The later decree, 1942 or 1943, whichever it was, rescinded this authorization. It wasn't allowed anymore. It allowed recourse only to milder measures such as standing at interrogations or performing fatiguing exercises.
Yeah.
Karl Hoffmann at Nuremberg, and I can't tell you exactly what his position was because I don't remember, explained why these methods were used in the occupied territories. Yes, third degree was carried out during interrogations. To explain this, I have to point out that the resistance organizations occupied themselves with the following. First, attacks on German soldiers. Secondly, attacks on trains, means of transport, and armed forces installations, in the course of which soldiers were also killed. Thirdly, elimination of all so-called informers and people collaborating with German police or other German authorities. In order to forestall these dangers and to save the lives of Germans, third degree interrogation was ordered and carried out, but only in these particular cases. Of course,
they were really, really being overly fair and everything, so they would look like monsters. In spite of that, I'm going to try to remember this when we come back. In spite of that, they paint them as monsters when they could have really been monsters, in the first place. Okay, well, enjoy the break, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back in 5 minutes. No, 5 and a half.
Friend, bin ich eine Zone, Friend, zieh ich wieder aus. Der Mai war mir gewogen mit manchem Blumenstrauß. Das Mädchen sprach von Liebe, die Mutter gar von ihr. Das Mädchen sprach von Liebe, die Mutter gar von ihr. Herren Haus.
What a treat, huh? Welcome back, listeners. And that was the Gute Nacht song from Schubert's Winterreise. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that as well as it should be, by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, who is died a few years ago. What comment would you like to make about that, Margaret?
Oh, it's beautiful. He's got such a beautiful top to his voice. It's just, I can see why you call him sort of a baritenor. Though he's generally, I mean, he can go very low too, but he's got that wonderful top ring to his voice.
Right, right. Well, he was very famous, and you can find this on YouTube and other things by him. And if you go to the Heretics Hour program page, that's the single page that talks about the program. I've got the link to it to this particular one on YouTube, but you can always find them yourself. All right. Well, where were we, Margaret? I was going to remember, so we'd come right back to it. Do you remember
what it was about? It was about whether they were authorized to torture and,
you know. Oh, yeah. I think that's very interesting. I know what I was saying that I just wanted to get in there. I'll start out by repeating it, that just like with the Holocaust and these concentration camps and so on, you know, they didn't do all these things to anybody, but they might as well have. They might as well have killed them, exterminated
them
all, because they're blamed for it anyway.
That's right.
We'd be rid of a whole lot of people.
It's already been paid for about 1,000 times over. Yes.
Well, that's why this truth is so important, you know, because this is just, when you really feel it and understand it, if you have any sympathy for the German people, it's just horrendous. And I'm just so grateful to people like Renoir, who is not French. I mean, who is not German, but of course he does like National Socialism. And so he's the perfect business for me.
Exactly. Well, it's as a result of what he's learned that he likes National Socialism so much.
Yes. So, you know, I don't know. There's always seems to be only a few of the really, really good people. too bad we don't have a whole lot of really, really good people, but I guess there never will be.
Yeah, so
you have to get those others to just follow along. You have to get some control, and then they'll just follow along.
Exactly. You don't have to have a majority. Power. Just enough people aware so that they don't stand in the way of change.
Right.
Enough people who've been unbrainwashed. And that does seem to be happening more and more. I think just when you go to a site, some just not really revisionist type site, and you see some of the comments sometimes, or even just look at the likes and dislikes, you know, the thumbs up, you're like, wow, a lot of people are awake these days, much more than 5 years ago, I think. Don't you think that's true?
Well, I keep hearing people saying it. I'm not real big on following comments on these big sites, but I keep hearing people saying it, so I'm hoping it's true. But I did have this, I mentioned it, I guess just not too long ago, a few days ago or so, that that I had this experience, this realization, thinking about how everything rises and falls, like with the stock market. But, you know, when you think it's never going to rise again, it does rise, you know, and it's always going to rise again. So then I thought, well, gosh, then that's true of everything. That's a universal law of life. And of human life anywhere, of, you know, our kind of the life that we're immersed in. And so, you know, it has to rise again.
Exactly.
Our thinking has to rise again, yeah.
Yep, this regime of one-sided lies cannot last forever.
No. So that gives me hope, and we're working for that. And if it doesn't happen in my lifetime, I don't care, as long as I can think that it will happen, and therefore I'll just keep, you know, we need to keep it alive. It's very important to keep all this alive as much as possible.
Yes. Joaquin Bochaca likened it to being in a sinking ship and putting a note in a bottle. Not a very cheery one idea in a way, but he said it's a metaphysical imperative.
Well, that's very good, and I think it is cheery, because it's the opposite of thinking that all is lost and it's hopeless, you know, and we're all going down into some black hole or something. No, that's not going to happen. So that's cheering enough for me. So why don't you go on?
Okay. Well, I'll go back for a second just to this last sentence of what this Carl Hoffman said about why the Germans had to use third degree techniques sometimes. He says, in order to forestall those dangers of the assassinations, the attacks on trains, the killing of informers and collaborationists, etc., in order to forestall those dangers and to save the lives of Germans, third degree interrogation was ordered and carried out, but only in these particular cases. But what I want to just mention is that he left out, he says, to save the lives of Germans, but he's just said they killed French people also. So it's also saving the lives of French people.
They blew up French people without any problem when they were trying to sabotage and blow things up and so on.
Exactly. And after the war was over, they killed 100,000 more of them, just no problem. So this was the resistance organizations who were doing that. And the point that Raynouard did not make, but which I'd like to make in relation to this, is that the partisans in the occupied territories did practice torture. Not only much more than the Gestapo did, but much, much more savagely. I mean, remember, a lot of these people are Jewish communists who did the torture in the Soviet Union. You know, horrible, horrible torture. And not for the purpose of extracting crucial information, but for terroristic purposes of revenge and deterrence. And perhaps out of the sadism of which they endlessly accused the Germans. I mean, it was terrible, the things that these partisans did.
Oh, hideous. Hideous. The German soldiers knew about it. They had come upon some of it, and that spreads around. And they were, you know, that was that's like terrorism. You know, that was to spread terror amongst the German soldiers so they would, you know, just be frozen in fear of getting caught by these partisans and having that done to them. And it was, it's, that was a huge part of the battle. So going after these partisans was absolutely necessary and justified. And
that's
and
right. But they didn't,
but
they didn't retaliate in kind.
No, they did retaliate that way, but to shoot them and into pits and so on was nothing wrong with that. They had to exterminate them. Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was legal. And they often had, they said, well, they didn't give them a trial. You know, you're supposed to give them a trial out there in the field, you know, with the generals or whatever the heck. Well, they didn't always do that. Well, they did sometimes. I know they did. Sometimes.
But not always. Yeah, non-uniformed combatants can be shot on sight, as I understand it.
They didn't do anything that was not legal under that time. Nothing that they did was. But I don't know. They just twisted around.
Yes, yes. So the official story about the torturing Gestapo was born, or at least received its official status at Nuremberg. The prosecution claimed that wherever they held sway, the Nazis tortured all their adversaries ceaselessly. Here's a little excerpt from the daily Le Monde from 22nd November 1945, which was at the time of the Nuremberg summation of their prosecution. It says, "This summation for the prosecution is the history of the terrorization and torture of Europe for more than 10 years. The history of assassination attempts, murders, tortures, everywhere the Nazi reign prevailed, deportations, tortures, concentration camps, and gas chambers were the result." On the 17th of January 1946, in his opening summation, French prosecutor François de Menton said, "We are, in fact, faced by systematic criminality which derives directly from a monstrous doctrine put into practice with deliberate intent by the masters of Nazi Germany." Except, as Renoir points out, if you're going to have such systematic criminality put in place for 4 years on a European scale, you would have had to have general orders. But defense witnesses and the defendants were adamant. Between 1933 and 1945, no order was ever received by the police services that authorized recourse to torture against resistance members. In fact, there were stringent rules against mistreatment of prisoners. Here's an interchange that shows that. Dr. Hensel, who was, I don't know, one of the people of the court, but I forget, probably a defense counsel. He says, "According to your knowledge, were there regulations prohibiting the physical ill-treatment of concentration camp inmates, and were these regulations known in the SS? And this was Kaltenbrunner he was asking. And Kaltenbrunner says, "They were issued in print, that is, contained in nearly every gazette of the Reichsführer SS and the chief of the German police. Every SS man knew these regulations were laws, and they were punished heavily if ill treatment was reported or became evident. They had their own SS and police courts. I can characterize this system in one sentence by stating that the penalties were much more severe than in a civil court." For its part, the prosecution was unable to produce one single German order authorizing torture. So then we get to the next section, which is, did the Gestapo torture? Now we know they were not authorized to torture, but did they? In this section, he analyzes testimonies in the post-liberation, quote-unquote, French trial records that allege torture by the Gestapo, and he finds out that a lot of them don't hold up. For example, was there a cold room in the Rue de Londres, one of the auxiliary police headquarters of the Georgia Gestapo. During the trial of the Georgia Gestapo, they were accused of possessing a cold room in which prisoners were confined. But at the hearing, the witness who'd mentioned the cold room explained that it was the result of a misunderstanding. The government commissioner says, "You spoke of a cold room." Hélène de Trance says, "It was an office that was not heated. That's why I mentioned a cold room. I called it that. I was so confused. When I said a cold room, I meant an unheated office."
See, that's the way they do that, though. They take that and say, "Oh, they had a cold room where they, you know, brought the temperature down to freezing or something."
They
do that. They don't care. They're not looking for the truth. They're just jumping on things.
That's right. And what about alleged traces of blood at 93 Rue Lauriston? That's the headquarters of the Bonny-Lafont group. And at the time of the quote-unquote liberation, there were stories about traces of blood that were supposedly discovered there that attested to abominable tortures. During the Bonny-Lafont trial, a witness testified who had actually been there, been one of the first persons to enter the Gestapo headquarters after its liberation, and had seen everything. The president of the trial asks him, "You saw no inscriptions on the walls, no traces of blood?" Monsieur Sec says, "Traces of blood, no. There were inscriptions on the walls. The unfortunate persons confined there must have been very bored. They kept calendars on the walls. But no traces of blood and no instruments of torture." To my knowledge, Renoir wrote, no proof of the existence of any torture chambers was ever discovered in the premises occupied by German police forces. I assume he also means or their auxiliaries.
Yeah. Well, so, there you go. Was this at Nuremberg?
No, this was one of the French trials. It was the Bonny-Lafont trial.
Okay. Well, that's so good, you know.
Mm-hmm. Many of the accusations of made by witnesses are contradicted by either by other witnesses or by the accused, and often it's very it looks very likely that it's the accusers who are lying. Renoir writes about the fact that people often dismiss the exculpatory testimony of defendants because they have an obvious motivation to lie to save their skins, but they fail to take into account that the witnesses for the prosecution also have a strong motive to lie, hatred of the Germans. Mm-hmm. Or I think also, that's what he said, but I think they could have other motivations. There's social pressure, it could be all kinds of things. But here's a quote from the Georgia Gestapo trial that illustrates the almost hysterical and clearly socially approved German hatred that was de rigueur at that time. The witness says, who's a woman, she says, "The death penalty, that's what you deserve, the whole gang of you here in court, including the women. All traitors to France should be executed. The guillotine is too good for you. There are enough people in court to lynch you right here and now." Instead of calling the witness to order, the president of the high court ratcheted the German hatred up a notch. He says, "They will never have suffered the torments of Buchenwald." Yeah, they're already doing it.
And they're doing that in court.
Yeah. So that's the judge who's supposed to be an impartial whatever, but nope.
Oh, boy.
So Renoir comments about this. He says, "Who can believe that in such a climate, these hate-filled witnesses would not have suffered from a tendency to forget facts favorable to the defendants, or to lie to increase their guilt and obtain the death penalty that they so much want to see inflicted." Of course, not all the testimonies alleging violence by German police were lies or exaggerations. So we get to the next section, which is reasons why the Gestapo, towards the end, often used violence.
Okay.
I guess he must have, because I wrote often, so I guess he said often, not just sometimes, but things were getting pretty tense then. At Nuremberg, the prosecution itself did not dispute the fact that the resistance leaders or members could be sentenced to death, as we spoke of before, and executed as illegal combatants. What they criticized the Germans for was for torturing them. But the fact is that a dead illegal combatant is not much use when what one desperately needs is information in order to prevent further attacks.
Yeah.
The Germans were faced with what tacticians call asymmetrical warfare between a well-equipped regular army and guerrilla groups whose great advantages were their invisibility in the greater population and their ability to strike at vulnerable points unexpectedly. In fact, secrecy was so vital to their mission that Article 3 of Circular Letter Number 2, published by the Résistance, declared, "Any person requesting admission into the Maquis de la Résistance will maintain the most absolute secrecy as to the location of the hiding places, the identity of the leaders, and his comrades. Any violation of this prohibition will be punished by death." So obviously, aside from patriotic principles of the partisans, when they're captured, they'd be unlikely to give information willingly to their captors because they've got a death threat looming over their heads if they do. Uh-huh. Hence, yeah, so therefore you've got a frequent need for strong measures by the Germans and their auxiliaries who were trying to get the maximum amount of information, names of accomplices and leaders, meeting places, weapons cache locations, forthcoming plans of action, etc. Renoir gives several examples of cases in which enhanced interrogations produce useful information, leading in one case to the decapitation of a resistance network and another to the location of a clandestine radio transmitter. But he makes 5 points about the Gestapo's use of violence. And he supports each one with trial testimony, which we don't have time to go into. But here are the 5 points. They did not resort to violence in minor affairs. And even in important cases, violence was not always used. They used violence only when the detainee would not talk, and they warned suspects first that it would be better to talk. And lastly, those who talked were not harmed. Therefore, Renoir writes, it's absolutely dishonest to attribute the violence suffered by Résistance members to Nazi sadism. Most of the time, German agents did not act out of sadism. They acted to extract information required for the supreme struggle.
Well, what kind of torture were they doing? I see they're talking about swollen faces and stuff here.
Yeah, I don't have much written here, but one example is the bathtub treatment. What's the bathtub treatment? It's putting him in a bath of cold water. A bathtub filled with cold water. Put him in it. Of course, nobody likes that, but I mean, in terms of torture. Well, I mean, I think they hit them, you know.
Yeah. So they're in this bathtub with cold water and they're asking them questions.
Yeah.
And telling them if they'll answer, they'll take them out of the bathtub. That doesn't sound
exactly
real bad.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it just does not rise to what we usually think of as torture, I must say. I've heard nothing about electrodes on genitals or splinters on fingernails or any of those horrible things. No, it's beating them up a little, like what you see in TV police dramas that everybody thinks is just fine if our guys do it, you know, which I think is terrible myself, you know, how they harden people to that. But, you know, you have somebody go in who's a suspect and they start kind of, socking him a little and, you know, I think that's more, it was third degree. It was not what's normally thought of as torture. But, you know, it's not great, but they were in a very, very difficult place.
Yeah, right.
And what you see, when you see what happened after the war, then you see what they were trying to prevent.
You know, if you're a patriot for your own people, and you're like a German and you're there working at this, and you hear and you know about the things that they're doing to German partisans have done in the way of blowing up and, you know, torturing themselves, the ones they get hold of and so on. If I'm one of those people, I'm going to be, I don't think I should have to cover it up. I don't think I should have to control myself totally or anything. You're going to pay him back.
Yeah, but I think,
I mean, I know that's not the right way to talk, but I mean, that's the way I feel.
Yeah, but I think most of the time, with this is Renoir's point, being German and having these guidelines, they mostly did not.
Well, yeah. Well, they couldn't because they were going to be punished if they did. So that stops you. Mm-hmm. But you sure have the, you know, you sure don't feel any time, don't feel like you should be protecting these people.
Yeah, and of course. Yeah. And Renoir made that point earlier about, you know, as the war wore on and these partisan atrocities happened more and the tide of the people's feelings was turning against them because of it and everything was happening, you know, of course their mood got worse.
Yeah. That's right.
Unsurprisingly, the French trial transcripts reveal that the interrogators for the liberators with supreme hypocrisy used violence in their interrogations of the defendants. This is the French courts after the quote unquote liberation are putting these Gestapo auxiliary people on trial. And of course, they're torturing them to get confessions.
And these are the French people.
Yeah, the French people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interrogations of the defendants who stood accused of, among other things, using violence in their interrogations.
Yeah.
And here's an example. In the 1947 trial of the French auxiliaries of the Gestapo, here's an exchange. Monsieur le Président of the tribunal, you stated in the course of your interrogation yesterday that you were in charge of trafficking merchandise obtained by armed robbery and that this traffic netted you 5,000 to 8,000 francs per week. Ferdinand Jouer, the defendant, says, Monsieur le Président, it's true, I did say that, but it was pure invention on my part. Monsieur le Président says, it was pure invention on your part. For what purpose? Jouer says, so as not to be beaten anymore. Monsieur le Président, very well. In other words, his interrogators had used violence for the purpose of extorting a confession from him, something the Gestapo was strictly forbidden to do. In the German police forces, third-degree methods were allowed only for the purpose of eliciting information vital for the struggle. And it's clear from the transcripts that this is the purpose for which they used them. During the same trial, another defendant testified that after he had made a full statement to his French captors without coercion, he was beaten by 5 inspectors and then thrown into a dungeon, nude, chained hand and foot. As Kaltenbrunner made clear in his Nuremberg testimony that I cited above, if German police or their subordinates had been caught perpetrating such an atrocity, which was obviously not to obtain information, but for revenge or pure sadism, the punishment would have been severe. So, rampant hypocrisy.
Right. Well, we know that's going on all the time. Okay.
And this is the last section of it, which is the behavior of the Gestapo towards women and girls.
Yeah, it says young girls.
Women and girls, the treatment of women and girls at the hands of the Gestapo. Historical accounts of which provided endless fodder for popular literature from
some of those, that pornography, those book covers and so on.
Yeah,
and all that pornography, they show them, you know, with
Stalag,
these
the Israeli Stalag porn.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah, of course, as you would suspect, the facts that Renoir unearthed are totally at odds with this popular image. At Nuremberg, in his report on the German atrocities committed during the occupation, Professor Pocot claimed that the women and young girls were almost always completely undressed out of pure sadism. But Renoir writes, this is untrue, of course. In the thousands of pages which I have read, which he read in the library of all the transcripts, there is no question of undressing, rape, or even improper gestures or touching. On the contrary, he quotes several testimonies from the French trials in which women explicitly state that they were treated quite correctly. Of course, such tame and unimaginative testimony did not serve the purpose of the Nuremberg Tribunal. They produced a certain Major Pierre Loranger, who made a lurid declaration. He said that after investigating the acts of the German police services in France, here is what he found. To the physical torments, the sadism of their torturers added the particularly painful moral torment for a woman or young girl of being undressed and stripped naked by her torturers. The condition of pregnancy did not protect them from blows, and when the brutalities entailed the expulsion of the product of conception, they were left without care, exposed to all the accidents and complications of this criminal abortion.
What a big lie.
It's a total lie. Yeah.
Yeah, total.
Absolutely. Of course, I mean, that did happen after the war in the East to some Germans in the Czech.
Oh, I can't, I cannot stand to read about that.
I can't read it. I don't know what happened. I can't stand it. You know, that.
I can't, I've got that book, what's the book, by the man who's Jewish, the worst one.
Eye for an Eye?
Yes. And, you know, a couple of times I tried to read it, and I just couldn't get very far at all.
Yeah, or just the depositions of the people from the Sudetenland. You can just
read. Yeah, I've read those. I've read those, but I couldn't read that book. I've read a lot of those.
I think that's part of the genius of the Holocaust narrative, because it passes the horror filter. It's really just not that horrible. They're naked and they go in a gas chamber and then they die. You know, I mean, they have these things about throwing the babies in the fire, but who believes that, you know?
Maybe, yeah, really.
But mostly it's just, you know, stuff that you can go, oh, that's terrible, oh. But you don't turn away. You don't say, oh, I can't read this, you know. Mm-hmm. But these real things that happen. Anyway, so that's off the subject of Gestapo.
Go ahead.
Of course, Renoir writes that these accusations by this Mayor Loranger are not confirmed by any testimony whatever. He presents testimony by a woman named Gilberte Saint-Demant, who was a 22-year-old Résistance member. She was arrested in Paris in February of 1944, and a search of her hotel room revealed a hoard of fake identification cards and materials for making them, and weapons, indicating she was a major activist. She was handcuffed and taken for interrogation. Here's her testimony. She says, as I did not answer, they slapped me right across the face with such force that I fell off my chair. They whipped me with a rubber whip right across the face. I had to tell them I was 3 months pregnant. Afterwards, she was put in solitary confinement in harsh conditions and underwent 24 interrogations with slaps and threats. When she still refused to talk, she was kept in solitary confinement for another 6 months. Then, the day that prison was evacuated, she says, I was taken to the Fort de Romainville and from there to the hospital where I had my little girl on August 25th. Renoir's comment is, of course, her story is quite regrettable, but if one does not wish to be beaten and endanger the life of one's baby, one should not participate in an illegal war. One should not steal official papers and stamps from the enemy, and one should not deal in weapons under a military occupation. Moreover, as he points out, the testimony is noteworthy for what it does not contain. She was not undressed, and above all, she received no blows that harmed her baby or endangered her pregnancy. In the end, she gave birth to a little girl, apparently healthy. So much for that tripe. Finally, Renoir describes several cases in which Gestapo auxiliaries who were looking for suspected Resistance members found their wives at home instead. In these cases, the women were, of course, not stripped. They weren't tortured either, although in one case, a 7-month pregnant woman with a baby had her face slapped and her hair pulled in an effort to extract information on where her husband was. Renoir comments, one must, of course, condemn the violence inflicted on this woman, but they could have taken her baby and said, talk or we'll cut one ear off, then the other one, etc. They could have stripped the woman naked, placed her on her back, and told her, talk or we'll stomp on your stomach. I must say that that's a very Renoirian kind of thing to write. When this was translated for me to give it in Barcelona, Bochaca omitted that about talk or we'll stomp on your stomach. Because he was sort of, he's too soft-hearted. He didn't want to put such a lurid example. But, you know, Renoir told me personally that he, before he got into revisionism, his ambition was to make horror movies. So, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Just, oh, I didn't think that sounds like him, but.
Yeah, well, anyway, so they did not put her on her back and tell her talk or we'll stomp on your stomach. No, she refused to talk, and after they searched the premises, they left. In another case, they offered a woman a 100,000 francs to reveal her husband's location. In another one, they posed as members of the Resistance to try to get information. And in another one, they simply gave the wife a phone number to call when her husband returned. Renoir's final example is worth quoting at more length. He entitles it, The Surprising Admission of a Woman Who Was Not Mistreated Either. It's the case of Monsieur and Madame Marceron, a married couple in the Résistance, who were concealing 6 cases of explosives in their home. They'd been betrayed by a detainee, so when the agents arrived, they knew what they ought to find. Of course, the couple denied everything. The woman testified later. She says, my husband replied, smiling, that we obviously weren't the kind of people who kept explosives around the house. I answered in the same vein that I didn't understand what they were talking about. The woman had her small child with her, aged 2.5. The agents, who had no time to waste, could have used either the child or the mother or both to force the husband to talk. Talk or we'll blow their brains out. But they didn't. After searching the house and finding nothing, they announced that they were taking the husband in for questioning, probably to confront him with the person who had betrayed him. At trial, Madame Merceron recalled, I asked them whether they would let him eat a little bit and get dressed. They agreed immediately. My husband then started to eat breakfast. These men, accompanied by the Germans, asked if they could eat breakfast with him, telling me they would pay. I said, if you want to eat, eat with my husband. Just help yourselves. After eating breakfast, they left with the suspect. A few hours later, Monsieur Merceron returned and declared, they knew everything. Madame Mesclot told them everything. He had to reveal the hiding place of the explosives. The Germans deported him to Germany, but they left the mother in liberty and never touched the child. Moreover, at trial, Madame Merceron had the courage to end her deposition by declaring, before she was interrupted by the president of the tribunal, I have nothing against the Germans. Of course there are enemies, that's obvious. A German defends his country, we defend ours. That's as far as she got. No, we don't want to hear that. Such was the behavior of the Gestapo towards the wives of Resistance members. Very far from the image propagated by the court historians and their dupes. Now, I think you had an example of a similar.
Yeah, thing. I do. But, you know, this is, I think, you know, I just absolutely believe this. And I've heard about examples of where they never hold the woman guilty of things. You know, they never, unless I guess it's some cases probably, but in most cases, they punish the man or they do whatever they do to the man and they leave the woman and child alone, uh-huh. Although they sent the man off to prison or camp.
That's
or something.
Right.
And this has happened over and over again. So again, they had these principles and they had these ideas about women, which is the way they wanted women to thought of women in their own country.
That's
you know,
right. Chivalry.
Yeah. Yes. And respect for women and so on. And well, okay. Well, yeah, I happened to remember this afternoon that, about this, what I had read in this book, The White Rose. It's really a propaganda, junk propaganda book written by Eng Scholl, the older sister of the two Scholls that were, executed. And in this, there's a, when Sophie Scholl was detained and she was undergoing interrogation, and she finally confessed after about one night. By early morning, she had confessed, and so had her brother, because the evidence was so strong. They slowly kept bringing out more and more evidence against them. They started out trying to deny, deny everything. That was their plan, the brother and sister. But finally, they had everything there, and so they couldn't. And then they confessed to what that they were responsible for all that was happening with the leaflets and the graffiti and the messages written on buildings and everything. But there was this woman who was a political prisoner. Now, this was in February 1943 in Munich, and her name was, where is she? Elsa Gebel. And she wrote afterwards, like a letter to the parents about, she was working there in that, jail or prison or whatever. And as a, she was a political prisoner herself, but they put her to work in the office. And so she was doing all this office work. And, they had her be a, after Sophie was brought in, they had her come and share a cell with Sophie. Now maybe they had it bugged, you know, and they wanted to listen to what they were saying because they were talking together. Because I can't figure any other reason why they would have this woman. She says she left her own cell, and they brought her in to share Sophie's cell, and so they had a little bit of time to talk together and so on. And so she wrote about all this, and Sophie's interrogator was a man, it doesn't matter too much, Moore, M-O-H-R was his last name. And I'm looking here what I have underlined. She wrote, she said that, after the first interrogation, she and her brother were taken out together. I mean, I don't know if they were interrogated together or if they were just interrogated at the same time, but it may be that they were interrogated together. And then at 6 o'clock, they brought them back to their cells, and some supper was brought to them, some warm soup and bread. And then a call came through and said, they're not to have anything to eat because we're going to resume the examination in a half an hour. But this woman, Elsa, who was a working prisoner, I'll repeat that one more time, had a lot of, she knew a lot of people there, and she found out everything. So she had a lot of freedom, actually. They didn't worry about her too much. She took care of all kinds of records and so on that they had to keep. And she said that, well, down here we wouldn't think of withholding food from them, so we gave them that food. And that strengthened them for their interrogation. And then they went back at 8 o'clock, and all night they were being interrogated all night. And Sophie said the next morning when she talked to her that they gave them real coffee to drink during their interrogation. Of course, again, they would do
that. That was a luxury.
It was a luxury, but at the same time, they wanted them to stay awake enough to keep answering questions, you know, because they kept this going all night and you could just fall asleep. And they were not doing anything to hurt these people in the slightest bit, except to have
because all they were after was a confession at this point. They were,
well, yeah, they
not,
knew
not that,
that
they wanted
guilty.
To anyway, but
yeah, but they knew they were guilty. They had all the evidence and they needed them to confess. Yes, but they didn't do anything harmful to them. And then, this one woman is saying how impressed she is with Sophie because she's so calm and everything. And, she said that, it says, she learned that that they were under interrogation all night long, and toward morning they confessed that the weight of the evidence in the hands of the investigators was too strong, and they even I already said all that. So after all, what they had and so on. But then, here's a little something. Saturday morning brings you, she's writing like in the first person, like she's writing to Sophie, but it's sending this to her parents. This is after Sophie's already dead. I mean, you know. So she says, Saturday morning brings you more hours of interrogation. And when I come in at noon, glad to be able to tell you that now you will be left in peace until Monday morning, it doesn't please you at all. You find the questioning stimulating, interesting. At least you have the good fortune to have one of the few likable investigators. He, Moore, is his name, giving you a long lecture this morning, gave you a long lecture this morning about the meaning of National Socialism, the Führer principle, German honor, and how grievously you had compromised Germany's armed security by your deeds. Perhaps he wants to offer you one more chance when he asks Fraulein, when he asks, and this is a quoting from him, the way she puts it, Fraulein Scholl, if you had known and thought over all these things that I have now explained to you, you certainly would never have let yourself be swept along into acts of this kind, would you? But her answer was, you are wrong. I would do exactly the same the next time. For it is you, not I, who have the mistaken Weltanschauung. And so he's trying to be, you know, pretty nice to her. And I guess he was, he kind of felt for her because she was, young female and so on. And he was sorry that she was going to be executed. It appears.
Yeah, maybe he was trying to lay a foundation for asking for leniency.
Sure, I think so. And then, but she wouldn't go along with it because she was determined to be a, you know, to start. They thought that after they were executed, the whole country was going to rise up. You know how we always think those things, don't we?
Oh,
but
yeah.
People don't, you know, they don't and don't think they're going to. But, however, they're heroes today. But then it says, that Moore, a few pages later, Moore steps in again to advise you to write your letters to your loved ones today, if possible. Since in Stadelheim prison, they'll let you write only brief notes. And they weren't in prison very long. They didn't go there for very long because they were executed pretty quickly. Well, they did have a trial, but that didn't last too long either. I think it was over in one day because they were pleading guilty by then. This woman, the political prisoner, her last thing that she writes is at 4:30, this is the day of the execution. At 4:30, Moore comes in, I guess into the prison, in that particular kind of prison that they're in. He is still in his hat and coat, white as chalk. I am the first to ask, Herr Moore, is it really true that all three will die? Because, you know, it's like after the trial, they were pronounced that they were going to be executed. And then they went almost immediately to the execution place. You know, it wasn't like these things, you know, where you sit around for a long time and wait.
Well, so, you know, that's more merciful, actually, I think.
Yeah, well, that's the way they did this. And she asked him that. And she says he only nods, himself still shaken by the experience. How did she take the sentence? Did you have a chance to talk to Sophie? In a tired voice, he answers, she was very brave. He got to like her, see? She was very brave. I talked with her in Stadelheim prison, and she was permitted to see her parents. Then she asked him, is there no chance at all for a plea of mercy? He looks at the clock on the wall and says softly in a dull voice, keep her in your thoughts during the next half hour. By that time, she will have come to the end of her suffering. And she sits there silently. That's about the end there. That's all she says about him. But now, who knows? But she doesn't have to speak about him in this way, you know, mm-hmm. in this letter. So these people were human.
That's right.
Agents were human. And they... they did their job and they believed in it. I know I can tell that this man believed in what he was doing. He knew
that's
it was right, but it
and
was
he
just
really
a tragedy.
He tried to give her a chance, it looks like.
Yeah, he tried to help her out, but she didn't. She wanted to go her way. And she always did. Boy, she was, I don't think she's a great person at all, but she was very, kind of willful and determined. You know, she was determined to get involved in that thing.
And very, very wrong-headed. You know, it's really too bad. You know, these days the traitors and the fools, you know, are held up as the heroes.
Well, that's right. You know, I think, I got a couple of emails from, someone who always listens live, and he always responds to my requests for things. And he said at 8:13, so that was just right after we started. I assume that's Central Time, my time, that I can hear you with static, but your guest is hard to hear. That might have been when we were, you know, going through some of this stuff. But then at 8:15, 2 minutes later, he writes, Margaret sounds good now. So I guess I'm not sounding too good. I hope the static is not too bad. Anyway, I'm going to let you kind of finish off here, Margaret. What have you got?
Okay.
Anything more you want to say?
Sure. I'll just read read Renoir's conclusion to this, which
okay.
is sort of ties it up. Though first I'll say I was thinking today about all these movies. Oh, I guess because Maria von Trapp just died. And so it's like, oh, this wonderful woman, what an angel, you know, anyway. But I was thinking about all these hit movies, you know, you look at them, Casablanca or The African Queen or Sound of Music, there's always those evil Nazis in the background. You know, that's how they do it. They want to make a huge hit movie where everybody knows, you know, it really gets in your subconscious. There's going to be Nazi villains in the background. And I was thinking about in The African Queen, they blow up this, you know, what is it, a submarine or some boat full of Germans? And all it is, oh, yay, we did it, we did it. You know, there's not a single thought of, hey, we just blew up a bunch of human beings. Because that's not part of the script, is it? That
right.
the Germans are anything but evil presences, you know, that they're not the
right.
same as human beings. But anyway, on to the conclusion. The Gestapo, Renoir writes, was therefore an ordinary political police force responsible, first of all, for preventing and repressing actions hostile to the state. Later, in the occupied territories, it had the mission of combating an illegal war. The excesses which it may have committed, and which it did commit, are not the consequence of Nazi sadism, but rather of the context in which it was compelled to act. The context of a struggle of life and death. The fault, then, lies not with Hitler, but with those who, in order to destroy his regime, unleashed a war of extermination in 1939. They were the true barbarians.
Well, I think that's a good, you know, I've come to that conclusion myself. In recent times, and I didn't always, I wouldn't ever have called it a war of extermination starting in 1939, certainly, against Germany, but I have come to that conclusion myself.
Well, you know, I read a quote from Harry Elmer Barnes. I don't remember what it's from, but he was writing, he said, at first, for a long time, I thought that FDR's unconditional surrender dictum was a terrible mistake because it caused so much more death and destruction. But he said, then I realized that was the point, that it was, the point was genocide.
Right. Yes. Well, that's probably the point that should be made now more and more to bring that home to people, because the Jews are trying to use and the Allies too, trying to, or whoever is supporting all those things, trying to use that idea of genocide against the Axis as much as possible, and really need to point out. And I think that's what they hate most, when you point out the genocide they were carrying out.
That's right. I mean, it was clearly, their intent was clearly genocide. You just have to read "Germany Must Perish," which is all about that. Or just look at what happened after the war. You know, millions and millions of Germans killed. And by the way, I have a message from someone saying the static is not bad at all.
Oh, that's good. Probably no worse than it was before.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, but I mentioned it, so he's probably letting me know that it's still there, that it was still there. Yeah, I didn't think that it was, like, real terrible or anything. So, well, so I've got 3 days off starting tomorrow, so I'll be trying to work on that then, figure out what I need to do. Okay, yeah, so we're left with, well, the usual lies. That's basically what we're left with here. The usual lies about that we're trying to counteract, we're trying to counter.
Mm-hmm. And it always is the same story, the correct, courageous Germans fighting for the life of their country and the lying, lying allies, et cetera, telling the big lie about them. And I, you know, you notice all the time, you can't just go and say, well, and this is what I noticed with the Holocaust too, you know, they tell such a huge lie. And then the instinct of people is to say, okay, well, it's the truth is in the middle. But you can't do that with something that's a total lie. You've got to throw the whole thing out, because if you say, okay, well, it was just 3 million, it's still a total lie.
Well, not, yes, there, I'm glad you said that, because also there are those who seem to be trying to move to some kind of reconciliation or something with good Jews, and more Jews will agree that, that, well, we exaggerated, well, we didn't, this isn't, didn't quite happen this way. But they don't want to be blamed for anything. Just like Paul Eisen said, he's working very hard for mercy toward the Jews when all this stuff blows open. Well, they don't deserve any mercy. See, and there's no middle ground here. There's no saying, well, we were wrong and you were wrong, so we'll sort of, you know, just end it. No,
they caused
tremendous, horrible damage and misery to people.
Exactly. I just saw a proposal for a peace treaty from somebody in behalf of the Germans. And one of the things it said is that no more accusations of war crimes from one side to the other, or no more, well, actually, you can investigate and reveal everything, but no recourse to punishment or reparations or anything. Huh? What?
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, we're gonna be cut off here. So I want to thank you so very much, Margaret,
yes,
for coming on tonight. And I hope people got a lot out of this discussion. And we'll keep this up in the uppermost and not let it get, you know, forgotten about.
Yeah, thank you very much, Caroline.
Okay, good night, everyone.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.